Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My first guest grew up in Hollywood and some years ago began writing a memoir, Following Breadcrumbs, Tales of a Rock and Roll Girl Child. She was the daughter of actor-singer Johnny Johnston, star of the movie Rock Around the Clock, and Shirley Johnston, a socialite real estate agent in Beverly Hills. Her book recounts stories of being a singer-songwriter and actress, like the time she had a beer with Paul McCartney and how she fell in love with two very different men. Jamie Johnston experienced living arrangements around the state of California, finally settling in Paradise, California. Her memoir was finished before November 2018, but then she had to add a final chapter about the campfire. Jamie Johnston, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I didn't go into detail about the career you had before you moved to Paradise.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So, but people in this area remember that that was a fire that destroyed so many homes, and you didn't know at first if yours would survive.
No, I didn't. Until I did, well, I did a when you do a drone footage of your street, right? And I went down the street and all I saw were little gray rectangles. And the story about my carport that survived, I saw a little green rectangle at the end of the cul-de-sac and knew that our carport had survived. And the carport does have a story, which I will tell.
Well, also people might wonder, well, are you by yourself? Did you have pets that you had to rescue?
No, there were two of us, myself and Rick. And yes, we had two dogs. And we all got out, and our instruments got out. I had go bags ready to go, everything.
That kind of surprised me, too, that you would have go bags. But then this wasn't your first fire. I read in your book that you were, I think, 8 years old.
8 years old in the Bel Air fire, yeah. And I remember evacuating. And I think we evacuated with Mel Torme's family. Really, we did.
Actually, that's not very surprising because your parents knew all the famous people in Hollywood. I mean, you've got a photograph in your book of people like Milton Berle and Gabby Hayes. Roy Rogers' cohort.
Yeah.
So your parents were quite the Hollywood elite.
Yes. Yeah. Yep.
So you move around and decided, okay, Paradise, that's where I want to live.
Well, it was because I could no longer afford living at the beach. I was a rep in the surf industry for years, and so I had to be near my accounts. And I was driving up and down the coast and surfing all these places, and I mean, it was ideal. It was wonderful. It was a reaction, actually, to a loss that I had in my life. So I hit the road, and that was the healing thing for me. But I could no longer afford to live at the beach. And shall I say where I lived at the beach?
You can if you like.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that later at another time. But yeah, I moved into a mobile home park on Pacific Coast Highway in Pacific Palisades. The house that I had there is now gone. The entire park is gone. So luckily, I didn't see that fire. But like I told our local news station who interviewed me because I was the Palisades Paradise connection, that the fire would have found me anyway.
So your house in the Palisades would have burned if you had been there.
Yes.
Yeah. So there you are. You've decided you'd move to Paradise, California. And you describe in your book how you loved Paradise.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
In fact, why don't you just go ahead and read what is the last chapter in your memoir. You had to add this chapter after the Paradise Fire.
Yes, pay the publisher buku bucks for that.
Oh, I can imagine. So why don't you read this chapter?
I will do that. I like to mention also that all of the chapters in my book, and you love this, you told me you love this, they are either song titles or lyrics from songs that people would remember from the 60s, 70s, 80s. And this last chapter is called Finale. Two tickets to paradise. By the summer of 2018, with rents rising around us up in Idlewild, We made a leap of faith and bought a sweet, rustic, two-bedroom mobile home on a third of an acre up in the Sierra foothills of Northern California. It was the kind of place where I knew in an instant that was where I wanted to spend the rest of my life. Enveloped in majestic pines twice the size of the ones we had known in Idlewild, dotted with oaks, dogwood, and liquid amber trees, we settled into our enchanted forest cul-de-sac, frequented by deer, foxes, raccoons, and eluding bears that seemed to get into everyone else's trash cans but ours. The property came with an array of vintage birdhouses everywhere we looked, placed strategically on poles or hung lovingly onto a tree limb, adding to the charm. My collection of bird feeders found they were truly at home, while Rick had turned to his own collection, his tools that found their perfect space, and the three sheds that also came with the property.
Could I interrupt you just a second? Because you just mentioned a name that you had mentioned before, but people might wonder, was he a brother? Was he a husband?
Oh, Rick. Rick is someone that came into my life. I kind of rescued him 20 years after I had lost his older brother in 1991. And, you know, so he is, yeah, he's my partner, my significant other. And I had never met him back in the 80s when I was with his brother. And that's a whole other story.
Yeah, but you were somewhat, he was not in good physical shape. You were his caretaker.
Yes, he's.
You were Rick's caretaker.
Yeah, I'm a caretaker type, I guess.
And here's an instance where you are taking care of him because the two of you are fleeing a burning city.
Oh, yes.
Well, we haven't got the fire yet, but you just said Rick had his tools there, and they found a perfect space and the sheds that came with the property.
We got there 5 months before the fire. Okay. Yeah. We had enough time to get to know our neighbors on the street. And I'm not going to get to the part where, because I don't talk about rebuilding. Obviously, I have because I'm here, right?
But not in this chapter.
But not in this chapter. But all of the neighbors that we got to know in that 5 months, we kept in touch, and we all spurned each other on as we were rebuilding and gave each other progress. And that a lot of that was what gave me hope and strength to come back.
Your supportive neighbors.
Yes,
in paradise.
Absolutely. Ah, it was small-town living at its finest, with annual events that were cherished by the townsfolk through the many decades that it had been a gold mining and logging town. Tribute was paid to that history by Gold Nugget Days, with a parade down one of the main streets, while the Gold Nugget Museum was filled with precious artifacts and irreplaceable collections from the 1800s. The beautiful orchard that was right up the road from us provided the apples every year for Johnny Appleseed Days, where volunteer baked pies were sold by the dozens. During the summer, there was party in the park where the local talent was showcased and local artisans sold their wares. The elevation wasn't as high as where we had been, roughly around 2,000 feet, but just enough so that it did get a bit of snow in the winter. In fact, it got all the seasons, unlike most of Southern California. And by the time Rick was on his way to Nashville in North Carolina to finish mixing his album, A Million Fallen Tears, which, by the way, gets airplay here in Chico, the autumn leaves in our new town were turning to breathtaking, vibrant reds and neon shades of orange. The wind had literally howled and rattled our windows the night before I got up early that November morning. As had become my routine, I went to the kitchen window to look out upon the vast forest and to survey the morning visitors on my bird feeders. Then I noticed the sky and thought, surely that can't be fog. We are so far inland. I went out the back deck and knew right away, as the unmistakable stench of fire hit my face, we had to run, and quickly. I ran to wake Rick and we started packing what we could, a bag for each of us and the dogs. Having lived in a fire-prone area before, I had a go bag by the bed with a few heirlooms, photos, and important papers. The last thing I grabbed as the lights went out were our pillows off the bed. By the time we had loaded up the dogs, the instruments, and what little we had, and at double speed had hooked up the little travel trailer we had gotten for this very moment, explosions were booming throughout the forest floor. We didn't know if it was propane or people's cars exploding, but we knew we only had moments because it was that close. The sky had turned black right behind us as we drove away from our peaceful little plot of heaven on earth.
Let me just interrupt for a second and let listeners know that my guest is Jamie Johnston, and she grew up in Southern California, but she moved to Paradise 5 months before the campfire, and so she is now with Rick, and did you have dogs with you?
Yes, we did.
So yes. Rick and your dogs and your valuables.
That was Chico and Zydeco.
So, and you had this dog named Chico before you moved to
Whole other story. I found him through NorCal Aussie Rescue online after I had lost another Australian Shepherd. And his name was Chico because he was brought into Butte County Humane Society. While I was living in Southern California, I drove all the way up here to get him. And then when we moved back, he came back to Butte County. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it is. So, again, my guest is Jamie Johnston, and she is reading from the final chapter in her book, Following Breadcrumbs, Tales of a Rock and Roll Girl Child. So now you're evacuating with your friend Rick and your dog Chico. And
Zydeco.
And your other dog.
Yeah. We joined a line of evacuating cars that were backed up and moving at a snail's pace. Finally, as we approached the intersection of two of the main roads out, we came to a dead stop. There was none of the impatience or rudeness one might find in a big city. No car horns blared, no yelling. Everyone seemed to be patiently awaiting their fate. When the fire continued to move closer behind us at that point, fire responders came running down the line of cars telling us we had to abandon our vehicles and come with them. We followed them to a huge parking lot that held new construction, buildings that were stucco with metal roofs, the thought being that there would be a bit more time before those would catch fire, or maybe they wouldn't at all. It was a crapshoot and a last-ditch decision to just save lives, because at that point, saving property was impossible. For the next 3.5 hours, and actually it was more like 5, Rick and the dogs and I huddled together with 150 other folks and their dogs and cats as flames surrounded us. Embers rained down upon us and at one point burned holes in my clothes. It was, as aptly described later by two writers for the LA Times, the best bad place. We could see what was right next to us, a sports shop filled with live ammunition, and whose spot fires were quickly put out by desperate firefighters purposely stationed next to it lest the worst-case scenario happen. We also saw what was right in front of us, the fast-drip gas station, whose gas pumps were sitting ducks, being lapped by the fire. We watched a home explode into flames right next to the fast trip. What we didn't know was that a propane field lay just to the northeast of us. The best bad place to be, but the only place we could be. We didn't know for those 3.5 hours, actually 5, whether our car, trailer, and everything we had left in the world had survived, until a first responder gathered the crowd together and said, "If you can get to your vehicles, we can lead you out." Bulldozers had finally cleared a main thoroughfare from the charred vehicles, fallen power poles and trees that had blocked the way down and off the ridge. We didn't know till later that many of those charred vehicles contained human beings that didn't make it out. 85 souls were lost that day, most of whom were elderly and couldn't get out from a town that prided itself for offering low-income and retired folks a wonderful and affordable way of life. This catastrophic event became known as the campfire and is now in the history books as the deadliest fire in California history. Though many structures and businesses did survive in the town of Paradise, 95% of its homes were lost, including ours. The only surviving structure on our street happened to be the steel carport we had just built. We were pleased to learn that the North Valley Animal Rescue Team had used it to shelter the stray animals that they had put food and water out for after the fire. The Gold Nugget Museum and its historical artifacts were all lost, as was Noble Orchards and their sweet apples and peaches. Now, I say Noble Orchards was lost, but it was not, because when we drove by there as we were evacuating, it was completely on fire. And it's true, they did lose. I'm not reading from the book now. they did lose
this
11.
This is information you found out after you wrote this.
After, yeah. Because we had left and we had no idea what was happening. So they lost all 11 buildings on their orchard. But the orchard itself was like down in a dip, and they lost they lost nothing except for their what do you call it, the water system, mm-hmm. that all burned,
irrigation system,
and the irrigation system and all of the buildings. But Noble Orchards has come back strong, and everything is just wonderful. I mean, just wonderful over there. Paradise Nation, as I call us, is scattered to the wind and nearly to all 50 states. There are those with that indelible paradise trait of patient resolve, like their pioneering ancestors. They stay on their land, surrounded by toxic debris and memories, waiting to rebuild. We survivors are all struggling with the memory of that day, and it continues to color everything we see, no matter where we land. For me, it goes beyond the material things, some of which can never be replaced. It is the loss of peace, of one's place in the world, of dreams and of home. I survived, but yet a huge part of me was lost.
This is my guest, Jamie Johnston. She is reading from a memoir, Following Breadcrumbs, Tales of a Rock and Roll Girl Child. And this book, she finished before the campfire, and she had to add this chapter. And even after you wrote this chapter, a few things you learned that you didn't know at the time.
Yes, and one of those is that Noble Orchards had actually survived except for the buildings. And I didn't know, I mean, there were so many things we didn't know because we were out of the state for a while.
Mm-hmm. So you left California, but you came back.
Oh, I absolutely came back. I mean, I own a third of an acre in, Northern California, and I was prepared to put a tent on the land. I really didn't care.
My guest is Jamie Johnston, and her book is Following Breadcrumbs. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Jamie Johnston, who tells tales of a rock and roll girl child in her book, Following Breadcrumbs. So you lost where you were living. You had this shelter that survived.
Yes.
And it was put to good use.
It was symbolic to me. I mean, it really was. It's like we had just put that there. And I made a joke about it. I said, well, our carport survived. I guess we got to go home.
Well, what were the kind of things that you lost in this fire? Because you had souvenirs, if I want to call them that. That doesn't seem an adequate word for some of what you had.
Yeah.
You had your musical instruments.
Yes, we got those out. But we didn't get our handwritten songs. Both Rick and I were both songwriters. And so all of the handwritten songs back to the 70s. Books, just so many books, all the vinyl albums back to the 60s, just all that. I had one of the worst things that I lost was a piece of Pete Townsend's guitar that he had played on the Smothers Brothers show in 1967, and I was 13 years old. And when he smashed that guitar, and it's on film, I mean, you can actually see the guitar. So there's that, right? But I grabbed the whole entire headstock with the strings hanging off of it and everything, and I had that all these years, and I lost that.
Since you were 13 years old.
Since I was 13 years old. And I lost, I'm going to give away the book now, I lost the framed copy of my recording contract from 1972, signed by George Martin, who was our record producer.
And that's one of the photographs. I really enjoyed your, you have black and white photographs in your book.
Not high quality, though.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, this the quality of that photograph of your contract is not very clear,
yeah.
but you include that. You also include a picture of you and your friend who, the two of you,
yeah.
signed this agreement, which didn't work out, but those are some of the photographs. You have a photograph of your parents' wedding and all
yeah.
the people of note who had
yes.
attended.
Maury Amsterdam, Milton Berle. Yeah, Gabby Hayes.
Yeah. Oh, I remember Gabby Hayes and the Roy Rogers
yeah.
movies I used to go see on Saturday mornings.
Oh, gosh. You're a little older than me. Little.
yeah.
Little.
So you go back. How long did you wait before you went back to Paradise?
Well, we were gone. The house came in 2020. We had a new manufactured home. I spent all my time trying to get that together while we were gone. We went through the, you know, the insurance and the hotels and all these other places. And I had a sister in Tucson who invited us to come there. And I thought, well, if I use this insurance money to do that, I will not have the money to rebuild. So I actually bought a little house in Tucson. I am not a desert person. And she said, well, you'll be safe here. And I said, yeah, that's because it's 115 degrees and you can't leave. So that was really hard. So I spent all my time trying to get it together to rebuild. And on the year anniversary of the fire, I actually drove from Tucson and came here in our little travel trailer. And I was here with, you know, one of the dogs. And I physically got in people's faces to get things moving as far as rebuilding. And so, yeah, 2 years, I guess. That's how long it took to come home.
So you were able to move back into a home here after 2 years.
Yes.
And what was the nature of this home that you moved into, if I may ask?
It's a new manufactured home with a porch. Oh, that's the best part. I mean, so I'm right now supporting and consulting a lot of people down in Altadena. Even though I had lived in Pacific Palisades, I wasn't so worried about the people in the Palisades because they are of better means or more means. The people in Altadena, it's a whole other demographic. A lot of those are legacy lots that families have owned for, you know, decades and passed down. And so I've told them, look, you own the land, you're halfway there. And they can't afford to rebuild in kind at today's prices. So I tell them, look, manufactured homes, they're not the old mobile homes. They're not, you know, they are really, they're on permanent foundations. They have, you know, they're fire hardened now. And that's the quickest way to get back and the cheapest way to get back. And there's no shame in it. So try it, you know. That's what I'm doing.
My guest is Jamie Johnston, and I'm asking her about her memoir, Following Breadcrumbs, Tales of a Rock and Roll Girl Child. And you said you've been helping people who suffered a fire in Southern California.
Yeah.
But the Paradise Fire, the Camp Fire, was the deadliest.
Yes.
Why do you suppose more people died in the Camp Fire when there was such extensive destruction by fire in Southern California?
Probably, you know, the elderly, like I said, a lot of people couldn't get out. For people who want to see Paradise come back like it was, all I got to say is 27,000 people trying to evacuate at the same time is not a good idea. They're saying now that we have about 11,000 people. And I'm reluctant to see it grow too much more. It scares me. They've got, 21 sirens in the town now. They've got designated evacuation routes and really strict code enforcement. You know, we've got gravel all around our house, which we had then, but we had pine needles on top of all of the gravel, and that did not help. So it's pretty strict now, but it was because there were a lot of older people in older homes. I mean, our entire street was older mobile homes from the 70s, you know, and in fact, our house had shingles on the front of the house. It's almost like a neon sign that says, burn me, you know. It was so cute. It was like, oh, a little hobbit house in the woods. And we didn't know. I mean.
I thought maybe two because of the limited roads out of Paradise.
Yes. Yeah.
That everybody had to just about, had a limited choice as to how to get out.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing pictures of just the cars bumper to bumper.
Yeah. Yeah, on the side of the road.
Yeah, and on the side of the road.
Yeah, yes, it was. I took the chance and came down the hill to go to the theater to actually see the lost bus because I don't have Apple TV, and you know, and I just I did it. I sat there and and clenched my fists and watched it. And what they did get right were the embers and the wind. I mean, that was really quite accurate. But yeah, I think, there's still a lot of streets in Paradise that are like a lot of cul-de-sacs, a lot of little streets that seem to go nowhere. Some of those streets, there were quite a few cars that with, burned out cars where they found people. I would hope that we've learned lessons from this, a lot of the canyons in Southern California. Well, what really was shocking to me was the alphabet streets in Pacific Palisades, and that which are up on a hill overlooking Pacific Coast Highway, and it's devastated, completely. Our mobile home park completely gone. The mobile home park next to that completely gone. And I don't know what's going to happen, with those guys, whether they're going to be able to come home or not. I don't think they're going to rebuild our park because it was considered, affordable housing in Pacific Palisades, right? But that reality is it was nowhere near affordable housing, which is why we left. And I mentioned Idlewild in that chapter. After we left the Palisades in 2014, we moved to Idlewild up above Palm Springs. About 5,000-6,000 feet up, so that's where we got into mountain living and snow, and and we were renting
and surfer
and
Jamie
yeah, surfer
liked
Jamie
it.
Yeah surfer Jamie 2 hours away from the ocean, so it wasn't very practical. I literally had to give up my sales job because I couldn't service the shops on the coast, and so there I was in the mountains, got a good pair of hiking boots and.
Well, you know what? This reading your book makes me wonder. You had a go bag. You were living in Paradise, as far as you knew. I mean, the camp. There was no fire. There was. So I was surprised that you had a go bag.
Yeah, I had a go bag and also a travel trailer. I got that travel trailer in San Diego, because where we were up in Idlewild, it was a 40-minute switchback road all the way down to the bottom. It wasn't Skyway where you just zip, mm-hmm. zip in 15 minutes. It was really, and I mean the thought of a fire up there. And actually, there was a fire that happened after we left. It was called the Mountain Fire or Mountain Center Fire, I think.
Well, I never lived any place where I thought I needed a go bag.
Yeah. But it's a good idea.
I see that. Now, even though I was in a place that a hurricane was coming in, we were ordered to evacuate. And I still, even now... Until just recently, I got something in the mail about flooding, and
oh, wow.
It told me to have a go bag because my area might be flooded.
Oh, right? Wow. You never know. No, you really don't.
I mean, I think you would, in listeners, even safe in Chico, a go bag sounds like a good idea.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I still have it. I have big plastic tubs of everything, ready to go. Okay, we had a fire, a couple of months ago that started in Concow, right? And there was wind that day. This was just a couple of months ago. And, the campfire actually started in Pulga and Concow.
Yep.
By 1 o'clock that morning, I was completely packed and ready to go. That's how PTSD manifests itself, okay?
Yeah. Well, you had reason to, but I think your experience is a good cautionary tale for have a go bag.
Have a go bag.
I'm concerned about pets or just the wild animals and the deer.
Here's the thing I'm finding out, and I don't want to scare everybody, but Chico, our Australian shepherd, he died 6 months later when we were in Tucson, nasal carcinoma. He was in fairly good shape, okay? And so So that was Chico. We got another Australian Shepherd and brought her with us to the land when we got back in 2020. We lost her at 4.5 years old from hemangiosarcoma. 4.5 years old. Now, Zydeco, our survivor.
Dog.
Yeah, our survivor dog. He's 11. He's a Catahoula mix, which is Catahoula. I don't know if you know, but they're the official dog of Louisiana. They're pig hunters.
That's the name Zydeco.
Yes, Zydeco. He just had x-rays and an ultrasound, and he's got a mass on his spleen and liver. So that's something that I really, really want to find out. The original land, the footprint of the house and around that, that was scraped twice for heavy metals and toxins. The lower yard where they play, I do not believe it was scraped, and yeah. So I'm in the process of trying to get soil testing because I can't. We also have now a 1.5-year-old border collie puppy. Yes, that's Daisy with a Z because all our dogs have Z. And Chico didn't, but he was before that. And I want to know, you know, like I put a post out on our local one of our local Facebook groups and asked the question, have you had any animals that have had cancer after the fire or people, you know? I have so far, I think I've got like 700, 800 responses. Yeah, in only a matter of like a few days, people have lost their pets. Yeah, don't want to scare you or anything, folks, but something to think about.
The effects of the fire just keep appearing.
Yeah, yeah. People also have had, you know.
I would think so.
Yes, heart attacks and the stress, a lot of people from stress. But, I mean, to hear about the animals, and if you go up to Billy Park and you go to the animal memorial, you'll see actually a lot of them are cats because people couldn't grab their cats. It's really hard to do that. So, but it's heartbreaking. It really is heartbreaking. And now I don't want anything to happen to our baby.
Oh, yeah.
So that's what I'm going to do.
My guest is Jamie Johnston, and her memoir is Following Breadcrumbs, Tales of a Rock and Roll Girl Child. And the book primarily is about your experiences growing up as a singer-songwriter, a voiceover, an actress. I didn't even mention that you studied acting with Lee Strasberg.
Yes, I did. Yes. Yep.
So you had this entire career before you became an expert in fleeing a fire.
Yes, right.
Oh, my
Yeah,
goodness.
That's called, well, I was well-versed in sense memory. So, you know, certain smells, certain, you know, I can, like, flash on the fire and stuff like that. You know, it's the ocean smell that I miss the most.
Yes.
I was a very happy camper at the ocean, but can't afford it. Couldn't afford it. So I had to, you know, instead of surfing, I had to get some nice camping, you know, hiking boots. And, you know, it's a different lifestyle. But I there's nowhere I'd rather live now than, you know, up where I am.
Well, it's been a real pleasure talking to you, Jamie.
Absolutely, you
and,
too.
And I know your future will be as exciting and adventurous because that's been the life you have led since you were born.
Oh, help, help. No more adventure, please.
My guest has been Jamie Johnston. And I've asked her about the last chapter in her memoir, Following Breadcrumbs, Tales of a Rock and Roll Girl Child. Thank you, Jamie.
Thank you.
After a break, my guest will be Judy Blishen Soto, who has written a book for children, The Fate of the Christmas Tree. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Judy Blishen Soto is a Native American of the Ohlone tribe, and until November 8, 2018, she lived in Paradise, California. All her writings burned in the campfire, and she had to start all over again. Previously, she wrote a book for children about her family's pet black Labrador named Tuck. That book encouraged her to write another book for children aimed at conservation and teaching responsibility for the future of the earth. In this latest book, an evergreen tree is separated from his family and faces the fate of all Christmas trees being thrown away after Christmas season is over. The title of Judy Soto's new book is The Fate of the Christmas Tree. Judy Soto, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, I wondered if your heritage as a Native American influenced your emphasis on taking care of nature and conservation.
Oh, yes, I'm sure it did. Yes. I don't know what to say about that. It's that I have an interest in acorns, and that's when I really realized that at a bus stop at the Cliff House in San Francisco, and I was gathering, and my girlfriend said, "What are you doing?" I go, "Oh, these are so fascinating." And so I brought them home, and she goes, "Oh, my goodness." And so anyway, I thought that they were very intriguing, their designs and everything, and then I ended up making acorn bread.
Uh-huh.
And delving into my heritage, and then now I'm doing genealogy and finding my roots and going deeper into my heritage.
Well, I think if somebody just saw you, they would never guess. You're a blonde, and so you don't look like that's your heritage, but it sounds like it's in your heart.
Yes, and I have high cheekbones. That is one of the indications.
Well, so you decided to write a book about a tree, and the main character is a tree.
Yes.
And that's unusual in itself.
And it's a journey, the journey that the tree goes on. And it's a sad story, but it's a happy ending, very happy ending.
In fact, people don't usually read the last page of a book, but I was intrigued by the very last sentence in your book. This is the story of the magical fate of a Christmas tree. Magical.
Yes.
Now, that sounds like it would appeal to children and adults also. So when people are picking out a Christmas tree, I just think that what the idea that you present is a beautiful opportunity to have a talk with the children and family and say, well, hey, kids, you know, it's traditional to have a live Christmas tree, but what do you think about having an artificial tree? And would you have maybe your grandchildren sit down and have a talk? What side would you take if I want to put the question that way?
Well, a long time ago, they came out with artificial trees because they were cutting so many trees down. And I told my children, I thought, maybe we, instead of getting a real tree and just leaving that tree up in the mountains, we'll get an artificial tree, and we can use it every year, decorate it. And so we tried it, and they liked it. The trees were looking very real when you buy them, so we got a 6-foot tree. And then traditionally, we kept decorating that same tree, and we kind of got away from going up in the mountains and cutting one down. And that inspired me to write this and how a tree would feel once it was cut down and all of a sudden it stops growing and where it goes in its journey.
You know, I think adults would think, Christmas tree, I mean, a tree of any kind, a tree can't have a personality. But when you're reading this book, I had a feeling that this tree had a personality. And I've noticed that I feel that way about just my houseplants, that I talk to them and I compliment them when they grow and look so beautiful. And so I'm just thinking children could have a feeling for plants that they wouldn't otherwise have.
I think so. I think that will happen because everything that lives is alive. And even though it doesn't talk or anything, but they respond. They respond to music. Plants respond to music.
Yes. And I think people would be surprised to hear that. They probably have heard that. My guest is Judy Blishen Soto, and her recent book is The Fate of the Christmas Tree. And I just can imagine that families, if they have a copy of your book, would be inspired to sit down with the children and talk about trees.
Yes, I think so. That's what inspired me. And then I took myself on a journey. I pretended that I was the tree. And how would I feel if I was up in the mountains and taken away from all the rest of my family? And it became a journey of living trees, seedlings, aunts and uncles, and different sizes.
And I think with your experience of the paradise burning, and you go up there, and there used to be so many trees there, and the fire destroyed the trees. And I think people often don't miss something until it's gone.
That's so true.
Or appreciate. So why don't you read us this story that you have written, and it's beautifully illustrated. I love the colors and the expressions. The trees have expressions on them. Why don't you read us some of this book, Judy?
In a little town somewhere close to the mountains, where Christmas trees are born and grow all year long, our story begins. This is a story about the fate of the Christmas tree from beginning to the end. It is a little sad, but true. The outcome is good and wonderful. On top of a mountaintop where Christmas trees grow, our story begins. Mama and Papa and all the newborn seedlings, along with their aunts and uncles and all their cousins, are growing happily. Life is good on top of the mountain. Winter is coming. The weather's getting colder. A few snowflakes are falling here and there. The little seedlings say to their papa, "What is all that noise I hear, Dad?" Papa coming up the road.
Papa meaning Papa Tree.
Papa Tree. Papa says, "Oh, no, it's that time of the year again. Well, little ones, I have to prepare you for what happens every time at this time of the year. It's called Christmas. And the humans from the little village all get together to drive up in their pickup trucks to the mountains where we live to look at the most beautiful and perfect tree to bring home. All that noise you hear is called singing. They sing Christmas carols, drink hot chocolate to keep warm. So, my little ones, I must prepare you so that you won't be the chosen ones that they take home. When they start walking through the forest, you must look like the ugliest tree in the world. Bend your trunk and your branches, and all of us will do the same. My little seedlings, we don't want to leave the mountaintop. And we don't want to be their perfect tree. So bend over, look crooked, so the humans will pass you by. These are words of wisdom for all our tree relatives to live by. Okay, here they come. I am the tallest and the fullest tree of all of you. So remember, whatever happens, Papa loves you." "We're scared, Papa," says the seedlings. "It's okay," said Papa. "Just take care of Mama for me." "Oh, no, they have chosen me." With that, the humans cut Papa at the roots and dragged him to the pickup truck, screaming, "We found the perfect tree. Let's go down the hill to the village and get ready to decorate our Christmas tree." So off they carried Papa as the tree family wept and cried for their father. There was an empty hole where Papa once lived. The only communication that they would have would be through the telephone wires. So the seedlings tried to comfort their mama tree with what Papa told them. It was a bumpy trip down the hill for Papa, and he didn't know from one minute to the next what would happen to him. They finally arrived at this beautiful house that was decorated on the outside with all these beautiful, colorful Christmas lights. Everyone in the pickup truck jumped out to bring me into the house. And like I told the seedlings, they propped me up in a tree stand full of water. I was so thirsty after that ordeal and almost drank it all. There was a lot of hustle and bustle in the house, with the humans bringing boxes from the attic into the living room and placing them beside me. There was so much noise and excitement with Christmas music in the background. Everybody was placing ornament lights and tinsels and big round balls that shined on my branches. Everyone was so happy except me. I missed my family so much. I could see myself in the living room mirror, and I must say I was very beautiful. I was able to watch everything they did to me through the reflection of the mirror, which made it very interesting so I could tell my family what the humans were doing to me. Around my trunk, they covered me with a white sheet so no one could see my wound.
Now, on the facing page is a picture of this Christmas tree, and he's being decorated, and you see the decorations, and you see the expression, and he's looking at the mirror and at himself in the mirror. Now, at this point, everything's happy, the family's happy, and they're all smiling. And you said it actually is kind of a sad story, but the magic hasn't happened yet.
No.
And all this seems pretty magical, but I want to save the magic, Judy, and let people get a copy of your book and read the magic that happens, because I think they'll be surprised, happily surprised. So thank you for reading a portion of your book
for
us.
Oh, you're welcome.
My guest has been Judy Blishen Soto, and the name of her children's book is The Fate of the Christmas Tree. Thank you, Judy.
You're welcome.
I would also like to thank my first guest, Jamie Johnston, whose book is Following Breadcrumbs, Tales of a Rock and Roll Girl Child. And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
What do I think about waiting for the light to change? More stoplights and longer waits provide safety, and they're necessary. But some things just happen to creep into my mind as I wait. Why do weather forecasters so often seem to go out in the stormy weather that they're telling us about? Rarely do they ever go outside when it's just nice and warm. But a storm, flooding, wind, rain, deluge, there they are. I was just wondering. Items sent on train are called shipments, but items sent on ships are called cargo. If you think some people don't look so fashionable in a swim thong, imagine them in a pair of dark lace-up dress shoes with no socks. Why is the word abbreviate so long? Shouldn't there be an abbreviation for it? If a farmer receives a farewell going away letter from his wife, would that be a John Deere letter? Why are the instructions on the little crimp papers inside of all the prescription bottles so small? Every time I try to read them, I think I need another eye exam. Don't you think the coming attractions to movies are often more exciting than the actual movies themselves that you came to see? If anyone does not know what introspection is, perhaps they need to take a good, long, hard look at themselves. What if I wanted to ask someone a hypothetical question? Is that possible? How come the song Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star has the same rhythm and tone as the ABC song for kids? And how come when we say the alphabet, people tend to say L-M-N-O-P, the L-M-N-O get shortchanged. The letter P gets its due, though. When asked for the last four digits of my Social Security number, I have to go through the first five in my head. You too? Maybe not. Why does no cleanser kill 100% of germs? What's so difficult about the 0.1% left? 99.9%. If someone clones that last 0.1%, we could be in for big trouble. How come only one of the three R's that schools emphasize actually starts with the letter R? You know, reading, writing, arithmetic. Isn't it ironic that the longest word that a person can type using only one line on a keyboard is the word typewriter? Oh, wait, you can go check it out. And why are keyboards not in alphabetical order? You can Google that one. How come names like Lloyd and Aaron have two double letters at the same at the beginning? Would one letter allow the name to be pronounced the same? Lloyd, Lloyd, Aaron to Aaron? The word laughter is joyous and happy. Add an S before it and becomes a pretty awful word. Slaughter. Yikes. Does Snoop Dogg have a birthday every 7 years? Isn't right now the oldest you've ever been and the youngest you will ever be? Swiss cheese has holes, A larger piece has more holes in it. More holes means less cheese. So, does more Swiss cheese equal less Swiss cheese? I've never figured that one out. If Einstein was so smart, how did he misspell his name twice? I thought it was I before E after, well, you know the rest. Why is it when you buy a new X-Acto knife from Costco, you need an X-Acto knife to be able to open up the blister pack? If you are up a creek without a paddle, how did you get there? Well, maybe you'll just have to get out the same way. Those ask me about my grandkid license plate frames. Have you ever asked anyone about theirs? I could just imagine. Hey, please roll down your window. I want to ask you about your... And then you go on from there. A baseball can be hit a number of times. The same ball is used throughout the game. But foul it off one time and the sideline attendant gets it and out it goes. New ball. Oh, and since you were also thinking about it, a baseball averages about 11 pitches per game before it's done. And then out it goes. And those pointy party hats with the tight elastic chin straps, either they're using less elastic or my double chin is reproducing. Okay, the light has changed to green. Time to move before the person behind me starts hitting their horn. People are just so impatient. We only sat through two green cycles. Mark Malinger.
Heavenly Town. Paradise was just not a name of a town. It was truly a heavenly experience. So close to heaven that you could touch the sky. Sometimes you could ride on the clouds and look over the town. It was a sight to behold. Sitting on top of a mountain, the view was breathtaking. Even the birds would survey the town as they flew by. As I gazed the beautiful view of paradise, an angel soared close to me, and I thought to myself, "Oh, God must be close by." By Judith Soto.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.